are an opportunity for the Urban Institute to showcase some of the interesting and policy relevant research that is going on at the Institute, and have a discussion with other experts and practitioners who have different experiences and different perspectives on the topic. Today's topic is tax credits for health insurance, and it is being informed by a recent analysis by Stan Dorn of the Institute entitled Health Coverage Tax Credits, a Small Program Offering Large Policy Lessons. The report is part of an ongoing series of timely analysis on immediate health care issues that has been funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and we are grateful for their support. As all of you know, the current tax code subsidizes health insurance by excluding employer-paid premiums and contributions into health savings accounts from taxable income, and by allowing employees to reduce their pay through deposits into flexible spending accounts, and also allows people who itemize their deductions to deduct the amounts over 7.5% of income attributable to health expenditures out of pocket. This structure, as all of you also know, is inequitable in that it provides no real benefit to those whose employers don't offer premium support for the health insurance of their workers, and it provides subsidies whose value is inequitably distributed in the sense that it is related to one's marginal tax rate. So for an individual who has no tax liability, it is basically worthless, while for those who face a marginal tax rate of 35%, over a third of the premium represents a tax subsidy. Given our current system, it's no wonder that most of the candidates who have suggested significant reforms in our health care system have suggested that we change the nature of the subsidy from a deduction into a tax credit of one sort or another. The fact of the matter is we know very little about how such a tax credit might work, the problems that we might have implementing it. What this discussion will do is draw on the experience we have had from this small program, the Health Coverage Tax Credit, and try to extrapolate to what might happen in a larger context. To start us off, we have Stan Dorn of the Institute, who's a senior research associate here, and previously to joining the health policy staff at the Institute, he was a senior analyst at the Economic and Social Research Institute and director of Health Consumer Alliance and the Health Division of the Children's Defense Fund before that. Commenting and adding a different perspective to the issue, we have Roy Ramtham, who is the president of HSA Consulting Services, which is a healthcare consulting practice that specializes in health savings accounts and consumer-driven healthcare products. Prior to forming this consulting practice, he was a senior health policy advisor to President Bush, and also was at the Treasury Department, or helped the Treasury Department implement health savings accounts. Roy also, I believe, if I'm not wrong, served on the Senate Finance Committee staff when I was also working at Congress. So we seem to have sort of taken that off.
Okay.
Maybe at your request. No. Following Roy will be Janet Troutwine, who is Executive Vice President and CEO of the National Association of Health Underwriters. She's worked closely with state legislators, regulators, governors, and others to implement purchasing options for workers who are eligible for the existing tax credits. In 2001, she was appointed to President Bush's Health Advisory Transition Team helped start the new administration off. Joanne Volt will follow Janet, and she has been at the AFL-CIO healthcare lobbying organization since 2001. Prior to joining the AFL-CIO, she was a senior analyst with Apt Associates doing research on state efforts to cover the uninsured and state high-risk pools. She's also worked as an aide to the Speaker of the New York State Assembly and so has a lot of experience with the state perspective on these issues. This is a terrific panel, and it's will be moderated by Jean Sturley. Jean is a senior fellow here at the Urban Institute and co-directs the Urban Institute Brookings Tax Policy Center. He's also a columnist for Tax Notes and the author of or editor of 11 books and countless articles. And I commend to you his most recent book, Contemporary U.S. Tax Policy, the second edition of which will be issued by the Urban Institute Press in a couple of weeks. Jean also was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Treasury for Tax Policy in the late 1980s. So with that, let me turn it over to you, Jean, and get the discussion underway.
Well, thank you, Bob. I do have to interrupt this discussion, however, for an important announcement. Apparently, the White House and Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office have come together on an agreement to establish a tax credit that will help promote universal health insurance, along with a mandate. They've decided that they're going to put aside all partisan bickering over this issue, and the Clinton, Obama, and McCain campaigns have all come together and decided that health policy will no longer have to be an issue in this campaign. Meanwhile, Bill O'Reilly and Ann Coulter have both announced that given the lack of controversy in this town, they will stop pontificating for at least one day. Now, that may be a bit of an April Fool's joke, but not entirely. I think, actually, as we see momentum on the tax credit issue for health care, we actually see a lot of different proposals that I think to many analysts are a lot closer together than they may appear to the politicians. And indeed, it may be an area that in which we could see momentum. Whether we do or not is something I hope our panelists will soon address. But just by way of further background, you know, we have had tax credits for health care. We certainly had a Benson tax credit. It was a small one. It didn't work very well, but it was enacted back in the early part of the 80s. We have a trade adjustment assistant credit that is available now, but it's not just for trade adjustment assistants, but Stan reminded me it was also for a PBGC recipients as well. We certainly have the president's recent proposal not to establish a tax credit, although he has indicated he might move towards a tax credit relative to his exclusion, and we have tax credit proposals in the McCain and the Clinton campaign proposals. I'm not quite sure where Obama is on that, although he has indicated some indication to think about mandates. So as we can see, this is an extremely active an important policy topic, and a lot of people are moving in similar directions, but not exactly the same, and partly because of the issues that our panelists are going to discuss in some depth. And since they've already been introduced, I will say nothing more than I think it's just a superb panel, really, not just in terms of the expertise they bring to the issue, but I think the range of expertise we have today really makes this an exciting discussion. Our panelists will spend about 8 minutes each teeing up the issue, and then we'll open the floor to discussion among them and then with you as an audience. So to lead off, Stan, please.
Thank you very much, Gene and Bob. I'm going to begin by building on Gene's observation that tax credits as a mechanism for health reform enjoy unusually broad support across the political spectrum. This is very important, I think, because we may have another shot at health reform in 2009, and legislation is much more likely to be enacted if it enjoys bipartisan sponsorship in an area of policy that's been extraordinarily divided along ideological and partisan lines. Tax credits are one of very few mechanisms that have enjoyed broad support. So it behooves us, I think, to examine the experience with the health coverage tax credit, HCTC, to ask, what does this teach us about the ability of tax credits to play a major role in larger reform efforts? And what does this teach us about how to structure tax credits if we want to use them to subsidize coverage for the uninsured? To help answer those questions, I'm going to talk about three things. When I was learning public speaking as a kid, they said you should always talk about three things. I'm convinced this rule has its roots in Christian theology. But even though I'm Jewish, I'm going to follow it. I'm going to talk about some of the accomplishments of HCTC, some of the challenges of HCTC, and some lessons for the future. In terms of accomplishments, the most important, of course, is that tens of thousands of people receive health coverage thanks to the subsidies provided by HCTC. In many cases, these are folks who would have been uninsured without the credit. It's a critical accomplishment. That's the most important thing that HCTC has done. The most important thing that HCTC has not done represents a second accomplishment. That is, the credit has avoided the problem of insurance marketing fraud, a problem that was very serious with the earlier Benson tax credits, which we've seen with Medicare recently, and which we saw with Medicaid managed care when it was first getting going. Now, to be clear, I'm not the insurance industry as a whole is an honorable, reputable industry, but there are con artists and shysters in those ranks, along with every other rank. And consumers get the government's money to spend on any insurance they want, that becomes an almost irresistible target for opportunism, unfortunately. And the problems have been not evident with HCTC because the credits can only be used for qualified coverage, which basically means COBRA coverage offered by former employers and state qualified plans, private health insurance plans arranged by the state. And so because you haven't had the kind of wide open freewheeling enrollment process that you've had with other credits and other programs, the program has avoided the problem of insurance marketing fraud. There's a lot more to say about other HCTC accomplishments, but to stick within that 8-minute frame that Gene mentioned, I'm going to stop there and move on to two challenges facing HCTC. The most famous of which, of course, is that many eligible individuals do not participate. In my view, it's impossible to come up with a valid single take-up rate estimate for HCTC. But I think it's fair to estimate that no more than 15% of eligible individuals benefit from the credit in either its advanceable form or its year-end form. And the surveys that have been done of beneficiaries and state officials working in this program give the same answer about the main obstacle. It's affordability. Most of the eligible workers can't afford 35% of premiums. And that should come as no surprise. If you work, on average, you spend 15% of the premium for worker-only coverage. And it's not realistic to expect that somebody who loses their job is going to be able to more than double the amount that they spend for health insurance. But there's a cash flow problem as well. Typically, you have to spend before advance payment starts with HCTC, people have to spend money out of pocket for full 100% premium payments, unsubsidized. Lots of people in this eligibility group simply don't have that amount of extra cash sitting around in household budgets. Now, a number of states have been clever and creative and circumvented this problem by using Department of Labor grant funds to provide essentially a mini HCTC, a 65% subsidy for the months before IRS begins the advance payment process. But that's a minority of states, and it's not a very sensible way to run a railroad, and it raises serious questions about moving forward on a broader scale. The second obstacle that I'm going to talk about is administrative costs. About a third of federal dollars related to advance payment go to administrative costs. To some degree, it's because non-group coverage can qualify as coverage for which the credit can be used. And we know that of all forms of insurance, non-group coverage is the type where the smallest percentage of the premium dollar goes to actually buying health care. But there's also an issue of IRS administrative costs. For each $4 in advance payment delivered to health plans, the IRS has to spend about $1 in administrative costs to make that possible. Now, why is that? The way advance payment works, IRS, first of all, invoices the beneficiary each month for their 35% premium share. They track that 35% payment. They then give it to the Financial Management Service of the Treasury Department. Now, with us today are some folks from IRS. I'll no doubt make some mistakes, and I hope they won't correct me. I hope they'll correct me during the question and answer period. Of course I do. Provides to FMS. FMS couples it with a 65% HCTC, sends that 100% premium payment onto the health plan along with identifying information about the individual enrollee. That's about a half a dozen transactions per month for each beneficiary. That is very expensive. Now, it was structured this way for good reason. The IRS and the Treasury Department were worried that health plans wouldn't participate in the program. Not that many beneficiaries nationwide, and in some ways, the rules for the program differ from those in other pre-existing health insurance markets. So to avoid the problems of health plan non-participation, they said, you know what, we're going to make sure that each plan gets one premium payment from one source in time for its regular monthly billing cycle. As a result, the government made that happen, and lots of plans participate. A survey a few years ago found that on average five options are available, state-qualified options in the median state. But that came at a price, and the price was hefty administrative costs for delivering the subsidy. So there are a few comments about the accomplishments and the challenges. What are the lessons going forward? Well, one lesson is you have to pay attention to marketing fraud. You need to think about enrollment. You need to think about what plans qualify. If policymakers say, oh, well, we're just going to give a tax credit and use it wherever you like in any licensed health coverage, that is inviting disaster in the form of marketing fraud, in my view. Lots of different answers are possible, but you need to think about it. Second lesson is the size of the subsidy is critically important, particularly if you want to reach the low-income uninsured. And remember, two-thirds of the uninsured are poor or near poor, with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level. This is no surprise. I mean, we've known from Medicaid, from SCHIP for decades, that relatively small costs imposed on low-income beneficiaries mean very low participation just because there's not that much extra money in household budgets. So the credits need to be quite large if you want to aim them at a low-income uninsured population. The final lesson that I'll mention is that administrative details matter enormously. And I think changed administration could have a profound impact overcoming some of the problems HCTC has experienced. For example, why do people have to pay monthly premiums in full before advance payment starts? It's because there's no mechanism to apply for an individual determination of eligibility unless you're already enrolled. In other words, you have to be enrolled in qualified health coverage in order to get a determination of eligibility. Well, there's an answer to that. Establish an alternative mechanism through which consumers who want to can seek an individual determination of eligibility, and then with a finding from a certificate from IRS saying, I am eligible for the tax credit, at that point the consumer can go out, find a qualified plan, and pay only their share of the premium, not the full 100% premium. We do this with Medicaid and SCHIP already. If there are forms of coverage where premium payments are required, you don't have to enroll and start paying 100% premiums. First, you go to the Medicaid agency or the SCHIP agency, you get a determination of individual eligibility, and only then do you enroll in coverage, and the only amount you pay is what you owe, not the full premium amount. A second example of why administration matters. Think about administrative costs. Instead of having half a dozen monthly transactions for each enrollee, there is a better way, to quote that great bipartisan political sage Jesse Jackson. There is a better way. You could have the health plans bill the beneficiary for their share of the premium, and then invoice the IRS for the health credit, paying the remainder. Now, this is also something that's done today in Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D plans bill subsidy-eligible recipients only their share of the premium, and at the end of the month, they settle up with CMS, with the federal government, for the remainder of the premium. Well, we could do that with tax credits, too. And in that way, instead of having half a dozen transactions per month per beneficiary, you would have one transaction with the health plan for all of its enrollee per month. And you could even do it once per quarter if you're willing to compensate health plans for the float. So you could redesign HCTC in a way that would substantially reduce the administrative costs, not to mention that a much greater program would benefit from economies of scale. So in short, it's no surprise that HCTC has had problems. It's had accomplishments that are often overlooked, but it's the first time in our country's history we've tried to use a refundable, advanceable tax credit to subsidize health coverage. It's no surprise that it's had some problems. You try something new, you always encounter problems. Now, think about how often Medicare and Medicaid statutes get changed. Not quite as often as my kids change their underwear, but nearly. Just about on an annual basis, these statutes get changed. It's been since 2002, and the HCTC statute hasn't been changed. It's clear. Every problem with HCTC can be solved. And now, with TAA reauthorization, Congress has a chance to do so. Whether they will, in fact, solve the problems is another question entirely. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Stan. And I have to compliment you because in order to stay within your time limit, you converted three conclusions with Midrash into a Jewish equivalent of 12. So. It was very effective. Next, we're going to have Roy.
Thank you. Just one point of clarification in the papers that were on your seat today when you came in. There is a health coverage tax credit fact sheet, which has my name on it, but I want you to know that I was not the source of this of these facts. This is information that I asked to be submitted on behalf of the Internal Revenue Service, who keeps the track of all of the facts of the program. And these data points are as of January of 2008, so these are the most currently available information from the IRS regarding participation in the program. So I did not make up these numbers. That's what the IRS is reporting. In my introduction, one thing that was omitted was when I was at the Treasury Department, I was also involved with the implementation of the Health Coverage Tax Credit Program. So we had monthly steering committee meetings, and I know a fair bit about how this program was designed and implemented. And I would agree with Stan that it's very important to understand that this is really the first time that we've ever tried a refundable and advanceable tax credit for health care. During my days on the Senate Finance Committee in the early to mid-90s, what was impressed upon me as a health policy staff person is that there's a very different world of tax policy that we are trying to bridge here. And I would imagine that most of the people in this room actually consider themselves more experts in health policy than tax policy. And Joanne and I were talking before the presentation. There is a different language that is spoken in the tax policy world. And it's important for the health policy people to understand that. The tax staff ended up writing most of the provisions in the TAA bill when it came to the tax credit. They were informed and involved with some of the health policy staff, but at the end of the day, that process is controlled by tax policy experts, and it's important to keep that in mind as we're looking at how we're going to get these policies correct. During my days on the Finance Committee, the only experience that I had heard about with tax credits up to that point were the Benson Child Health Insurance tax credit. Again, all we heard was about the marketing fraud with that program, and the other program was the Earned Income Tax Credit program, which also the only thing I heard about was that the participation rate was about 200%. So when you come to a program that involves a tax credit and you're then designing it for healthcare, you have these two large black clouds kind of hanging over you, wondering what kind of experience is this program going to have. And clearly it has had a very different experience than either the Benson tax credit or the Earned Income tax credit. And for anyone who knows whether there is more recent analysis of the Earned Income Tax Credit, I do not. I think it might be instructive for how we look at designing tax credits for these programs going forward. I think it's also important for everyone to understand how a refundable tax credit actually works. The easiest thing to do would be to file something on your tax return at the end of the year and claim a credit for the amount that you are eligible and relate that to your tax liability or to your income. A lot of people, when they look at tax credits, don't understand that they reduce your tax liability rather than your income. So if you have tax liability of $1,000 and you have a refundable tax credit of $1,000, then your tax liability is zero. It does not reduce your taxable income by $1,000, but depending on what tax bracket you're in, it could have a varying effect on the amount of tax liability that you have to pay. The advanceable part of this tax credit, I think, is extremely important because from a health policy perspective, if you are trying to help people maintain insurance coverage, knowing that some may have cash flow issues, this was part of the design so that people would not have to wait until the end of the year to actually claim their tax credit, although they could adjust their withholding if they're still working, but these people generally by definition are not working, having recently lost their jobs. That may work for other credit designs, but doesn't work particularly well for the health coverage tax credit. Making it advanceable meant that we had to come up with a infrastructure to help make that money available to people on a monthly basis. Not unlike how Medicaid and other programs do periodic eligibility determinations. This doesn't involve the same level of determination of whether people have income and resources and those kinds of things, but it does require determination of whether you have an insurance policy that is qualified and whether or not that policy then is eligible for a subsidy. And you write your check to the IRS, and the IRS forwards on your payment plus the government subsidy to the insurance carrier. As Stan said, it does not have to be designed that way, but that is the way it was designed. And because of that, I think it has become more costly than maybe it needs to be. So looking over the course of the past several years, I think that we have successfully demonstrated that a refundable, advanceable tax credit can work for health insurance. We can all debate whether the current model is appropriate for broader use for refundable tax credits as we look at expanding coverage to more uninsured Americans. I think HCTC has achieved some level of success, but obviously the enrollment and participation in the program has been disappointing. Initially, estimates suggested that perhaps 500,000 people might be participating in this program. And what we have found is much smaller numbers than that. In many states, it's only a couple thousand people. In some states, it's only a couple hundred people. And so we've had to understand that this program is serving a very, very, very small niche of people, and we are asking that program to operate under sometimes slightly different rules than the rest of the world operates. There are many people who are potentially eligible for this tax credit, but don't have the right type of insurance to actually use the credit. I think that's a mistake. There are many that I think could probably find much more inexpensive coverage, but they're not allowed to use the tax credit. And I understand how important it is to have appropriate consumer protections to make sure that everybody who is potentially eligible for the credit and qualifies for it could actually use it for some coverage, but by limiting people's choice when there are sometimes better options available for them is a mistake in my view. The rules that apply to these individuals are different from HIPAA. So for a very tiny population, you are asking the insurance industry to abide by a different set of rules. I think it's very interesting looking at the options that people have potentially when states are making their choices of what types of plans would qualify for coverage. One of the plan options that was made available was state employee health insurance benefits. So those types of programs that state employees participate or programs that are similar to that. And for those who think that using the federal employees health benefits or even state employee health benefits programs as an option to provide to uninsured Americans, I think it's very interesting that no state has chosen that choice over the last 4 years, yet it would be one of the simplest options available to them. We don't know why they have made those decisions, but they have. We also don't understand why so many states have chosen high-risk pools as the only option available to individuals. We don't really have any reason to believe that these individuals are of worse health status, although I do understand that the majority of the population, by definition, is in an older age group, 55 to 64, because they qualify through the piece of eligibility under the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation and must be within that age up to Medicare. Clearly, those on the TAA side of this program don't necessarily fall in that age group, and when you look at their average age, it is definitely much younger than those in the pre-retiree area. I do agree with Stan that the administrative costs are probably higher than they could be or need to be, but we also need to keep in mind that the infrastructure that was built was designed to handle 500,000 people, and unfortunately we built this ballpark and nobody came. So we have a lasting legacy of infrastructure that right now is maybe being underutilized. I also want everyone to understand, though, that much of the costs that have been incurred by the program have been something that has been a positive aspect for the program beneficiaries, and that is in the marketing and outreach areas, letting people know that this credit does exist, that they have options to use with their health insurance, and there is this credit that can help them pay for their insurance. There is probably next to zero fraud in this program. So while people may laud the low administrative costs of Medicare, we have $50 billion worth of fraud in that program. So there clearly has to be a balance between administrative costs and potentially fraud. The IRS also is very concerned of maintaining taxpayer privacy. So that makes other challenging issues that have to be addressed. If there was a broader population, I believe a lot of these costs would be spread over that larger population and would make the ratio cost ratios much lower. Finally, the evidence, I believe there's not very much evidence to date to suggest that the administrative costs would be any lower if this were a direct subsidy program administered by the states or by HHS. So that is something else I think we need to ask ourselves. Is this relatively equal in cost, relatively better, or relatively worse compared to other types of subsidy programs? And finally, the cost of being uninsured is much greater than the cost that the government is bearing to keep these people insured. So all points that we need to keep in mind as we look at fine-tuning this program.
Thank you, Roy. You reminded me when you referred to your Senate Finance days of a discussion I once had with either Senate Finance staff or a Joint Committee on Taxation staff person who made note that if I thought that sausage making was interesting when you wrote tax legislation, I should see what happens when they write health legislation. Janet?
Yes, I'd like to focus my remarks today on the purchasing options. Most of our work with the TAA program has been in working with states to get options up and running. And because, in fact, if a person has a tax credit and has no place to spend it, it doesn't really do them very much good. And I want to focus a little bit specifically on what we've seen as some of the impediments with some of the purchasing options as they're structured. There are actually 10 different purchasing options, and I'm not going to go through each and every one of them, except to group them a little bit by categories. There are two or three options that we would categorize as kind of automatic options. The state doesn't need to do anything in order for those options to come into play. And then most of the options require the state to do something. As Roy said, you know, any of the states could have allowed people to buy into their state employee program, but none have done that, and there are a lot of reasons why I think they didn't do that, which I won't get into here. States can set up a variety of different sort of private programs, and then coverage can be available through state high-risk pool, and those are kind of the basic categories that things fall into. You know, some people really hang their hat on the fact that COBRA is available, and I would just point out COBRA is one of the automatic options. You know, people can continue their employer-sponsored coverage through COBRA, or if their employer is a smaller employer, 39 states have state continuation programs. But that requires their employer to still be in business. And if you look at the nature of this particular tax credit, many of these employers have been impacted by U.S. trade agreements and didn't just downsize, they just shut their doors. And so if the employer is not in existence anymore, neither is their COBRA option nor their state continuation option, and so that is not a real option to them. One of the other things that I wanted to mention is that we do have, and I believe I have this count correctly now, 12 states that only have the option of a state high-risk pool. Now, for those of you that are not familiar, a state high-risk pool is a very important component of a good functioning individual health insurance market, but it was never intended to insure healthy people. State high-risk people, high-risk pools were intended to insure people with health problems. Yet, we have 12 states who, in addition to the automatic options of COBRA and state continuation, only have a state high-risk pool. And that would be a very good explanation as to why people may not be covered in those particular states. The state high-risk pools are more expensive than traditional coverage. And so it's not a very cost-effective means of having a purchasing option if that, in fact, is your only option. Now, you might wonder, why is that? Why do 12 states only have this option through a state high-risk pool? Well, the requirements of, now this is very important, the requirements of each of the options, all 10 options, each one is required to meet certain guidelines of the law, distinctly, not in combination with another option, each one separately on their own. So here are the things that any plan that the state sets up has to do. So any individual who has less than a 63-day break in coverage has to be issued on a guarantee issue basis, no pre-existing condition waiting period, and they have to have benefits and premiums that are pretty much consistent with what a non-TAA eligible individual would have. Now, even in states, and I want to just clarify this, even in states that have implemented both a state high-risk pool option and a health plan option, both of those two options have to separately meet this guarantee issue requirement, no pre-existing conditions, and they can have any number of people coming into these programs at any time. I would just tell you that this is very, very different than the way that these insurance companies operate in most states. And the individual health insurance market, which is where these buyers are buying into, normally in the majority of states, there is medical underwriting. And then if people don't pass the questions, you know, if they're more ill than that, then there is some sort of a safety net in all but a couple of states. The most common safety net is a high-risk pool. And the high-risk pool backs up the individual market, but it's not separate and distinct like it is in this program. And it's just kind of strange the way that's put together like that. So this is really a lack of flexibility, and I guess that would bring me to pointing out some things that could be done a little bit better. You know, if it was a perfect world, you know, perhaps we would have some really strong fraud controls, and people would just be able to purchase coverage that was available and had been approved by their state department of insurance in their state. But let's just admit that it isn't that world, and that's not the world that we're in. What could we do with the purchasing options that are already there, which have proven to be helpful in combating this fraud issue? Well, one idea that we have had is taking the options and combining them. Rather than each of the options serving distinctly on their own, what if you combined a private health plan option with a high-risk pool option, and you would have many, many more insurers participating in this. The cost of coverage would be dramatically lower. It would be affordable for many, many more people. And the people that are in states that have only a high-risk pool as an option would have a much more affordable option. And one last thing that I would like to mention in that regard is when people who are insured under this program, when their 35% is higher than it should be, well, guess who's paying the other 65%? It's the federal government. And that means the government is paying way too much for the coverage under these programs, and it's not necessary at all. It would be very simple to combine these options together to achieve the exact same goal that we're looking at now and provide better affordability and more coverage choices for many more people. I think we'd see a lot more take-up in this program if they just had a reasonable and affordable place to purchase their coverage.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm going to start by trying to answer the question put to the panel today. Are tax credits a linchpin for health care reform? And I think no, they are not. I think that overstates the value of tax credits and their role in health reform. I think you need to think about this as one piece of a broader effort that must address insurance market reforms and making sure people have a place to go for comprehensive coverage. So in some respects, we're looking at one little piece here, but I think it is worth noting that there is broad agreement that we need to do subsidies of some sort in an expansion. The question is how. And this gives us an interesting look at one way to do subsidies, the health coverage tax credit. But it also is an interesting look at some of the true barriers to getting health insurance, because the other pieces I would argue here are not addressed adequately, and so we've seen this very limited take-up. I would say on a positive note that the health coverage tax credit tried its best to be as much like a direct subsidy as possible, with the advanceable, assignable, and refundable features, and I think appropriately provides for a percent of the premium so that you don't have a flat dollar amount that would disadvantage higher cost and lower income people. But beyond that, I think it fails some key tests. It does not provide enough help to make coverage affordable. It is not linked to meaningful coverage that people think will provide them access to care, and it does not pass the test of simple enrollment. On the first point, whether or not they're adequate, I think you've heard plenty here about how the 35% does not go far enough, and I just want to remind folks that the average UI benefit, unemployment insurance benefit, is about $1,200 a month, and the average PBGC benefit for this population is about $700 a month. So 35% does not get you very far when you have other household needs to meet on your limited income, and is certainly a far departure from the coverage subsidies they enjoyed when they were working, which we know are far higher. And then, of course, there is the other complication that Stan mentioned, that you have to actually pay the full cost for 1 month or more, and then at this point wait for a refund at the end of the tax year for that amount, which again, on the severely reduced income, whether your benefit or your pension benefit or your UI check, is just not doable for too many folks. The coverage should be tied to adequate coverage, and it was not done so here. I think that the intent in the legislation was to limit the use of the credit in the individual market to those who had coverage there in the 30 days prior to their layoff or retirement. That is not the way it's acted in practice. In practice, the arrangement with insurer designation or option has come to look like the individual market for all practical purposes. There's medical underwriting, and so people experience wide variation in premiums based on age, gender, and health status. And then finally, the enrollment is not at all simple. I would just point you to the last page of the papers that were on your seat. I borrowed a page from the GAO report in 2004 that outlines the process for both the HCTC people and the PBGC people. You have to clear a lot of hurdles to finally pop out at the other end with an advanceable credit in hand. So, for example, you have to first meet the eligibility guidelines of TAA or PBGC or this other thing called ATAA. You have to then be a qualified individual, meaning that you had 3 months of coverage prior to seeking to enroll in a plan, which is another area that's been interpreted differently than I think Congress intended. They're looking at that point far down the road where you seek to enroll in one of these plans. You probably didn't have coverage in the previous 3 months. They meant when you lost your job, when you retired, did you have coverage in the previous 3 months? And then finally, you have to have qualified coverage. You have to be enrolled in qualified coverage. And there is that list as well. So you can see that there are just an enormous number of hurdles to clear here to be considered HCTC eligible. It involves two different federal agencies, a number of state agencies, health plans, and a lot of back and forth. And that begins with just the petition for the TA certification, which itself is a very complex and technical process. And then there is currently the linkage to the trade readjustment allowance, which is what TAA benefits are called, and there is an automatic 60-day delay built in there. This has the effect of contributing to more delays and reducing the eligible population for the HCTC. There's a fix that can be made there that just brings it back to the original TAA and not trying to link it to TRA, which gets into whether or not training spots are available if you're enrolled and so forth. And then I think generally there's been agreement, and GAO cited this in the report, that there are between 3 and 6 month delays that have nothing to do with the worker. yet they are expected to maintain coverage with a break of no more than 63 days in order to have the consumer protections they need to actually be able to get coverage with the credit they finally qualify. So there is no way you could construe that this is simple or effective. So I think it really does point out the true barriers to getting health insurance. Timing absolutely matters. To get or keep coverage, it has to be affordable. It probably isn't affordable without a subsidy, but you can't get the subsidy unless you've had coverage. And then, too, I think we've seen that people want meaningful coverage. One of Stan's earlier reports said that people said that they absolutely wanted meaningful coverage, even if it meant it would cost them more. There is just no good economic reason for a laid-off worker or retiree whose pension was just slashed to elect to pay premiums that they probably had to scrape all their money together to buy and then get into a plan that had a big deductible that required them to pay for a lot of care out of pocket before the coverage ever kicks in. That's just not a realistic option for these people. So I think these are the real lessons. You can look at making the enrollment process simpler. You can make the coverage more a higher percent, but you also have to address whether or not people can access the coverage and once they are, if it's meaningful and provides them access to care.
Thank you. This is a very, very interesting discussion. Before we turn to questions, I'd like to give the panelists a chance to react to each other, if they'd like to. Any comments on each other's presentations?
Well, I wanted to react to a comment made by Janet about the need to make sure that there's a reasonable and affordable place to buy health coverage. I think that's absolutely well taken. And I think Janet deserves a huge amount of credit personally for the fact that there are state-qualified options all around the country. I know that soon after the legislation passed, she was going all around the country encouraging state legislators to make sure that they offered a form of state-qualified coverage. And it was really an extraordinary accomplishment, and I think she deserves a huge amount of credit for it. And one reason why I'm glad she's here is that it gives me a chance to say that. I agree with her that there's a need for a place to – it's not enough just to give people a credit. You have to make sure that there's a place they can use the credit to obtain health coverage and coverage that they value. I think that Joanne's point is absolutely right, that people tend to prefer more comprehensive benefits. Even folks who've been recently laid off, even people who are PBGC beneficiaries who don't have a lot of money, if you look at the plans in which they enroll, they tend, given a choice between more and less comprehensive plans, people tend to pick more comprehensive plans. The question I would raise, though, is the non-group market the right place for reasonable and affordable place to buy coverage? I have questions about that. If you're an older person, if you have prior health problems, the premiums you pay are much higher. You may be denied the services that you need. In North Carolina, for example, it was tragic. There was an incredible amount of work done by the governor, by Blue Cross Blue Shield, by the unions when the pillow textile mills closed down, the biggest layoffs in the history of that state. They got thousands of laid off workers to come and apply for health coverage from Blue Cross Blue Shield. Blue Cross Blue Shield knocked off the top two risk tiers. It was a medically underwritten coverage. They only said we're going to have five risk tiers instead of seven. And yet, once people got those medically underwritten quotes back, three quarters of the folks said, I can't afford this. I can't afford to spend 35% of the premium is thousands of dollars. And, you know, as Joanne said, some of the people said, I'm going to spend money I don't have for high deductible coverage that doesn't pay for the prescription medicine that I need every month. Forget about it. And huge numbers of people failed to follow through. So now I think there are other ways. I think Roy's point about making sure that the coverage is less expensive is a good one, but there are other ways to do that. You can have health insurance exchanges where everybody pays the same premium regardless of age, regardless of health condition. You can make sure there's a range of benefits that are available so you can pick between more and less comprehensive coverage. So I think that the points that were made are well taken, but I think there are better solutions than the non-group market.
I want to draw your attention on the HCTC fact sheet that has my name associated with it. On the second page, there's a little paragraph that says monthly premiums was approximately $750 per month. Now, I know from having seen other data from the IRS that the average is somewhat skewed here because you have single individuals and you have families claiming the credit. My knowledge of the premiums that are paid under the program, and this is the total premium, not just the government share or the employee's share, for single individuals is about $500 a month. That's $6,000 a year. That's about average in the market. So to say that these policies are a lot more unaffordable than anything else that they currently have, I don't think is true. The employee share would be 35% of that $500. For family coverage, the average is about $1,000 a month. So $12,000 a year, that's right in line with what the Kaiser HRET survey tells us every year. It's about $12,000 for family coverage is the average. So not widely unusually high coverage. But we also know that a lot of people are shocked and think they're being overcharged when they go on COBRA because they have no clue how much their premium actually is. All they see is what they pay from their own paycheck, and so they suddenly think that you're ripping them off, even though by law the employer can't charge more than 102%. On the eligibility side, there have been proposals that would greatly simplify eligibility by tying the tax credit to the receipt of unemployment insurance. And to the extent that people understand how the unemployment insurance process works, qualifying for benefits, if your eligibility to this tax credit were tied to the unemployment system, I would think eligibility would be a rather simple proposition, maybe a few less handoffs. However, if you are, it is tied to unemployment insurance, you're by almost definition talking about individuals who may have unemployment benefits that last 13 weeks, longer with extensions and those kinds of things. The nature of the insurance that might go along with a temporary benefit then is not the same type of insurance. It's almost like temporary insurance on the health side, which is a little bit different and has its own issues. So, you know, this becomes somewhat of a balancing act here, I think. Clearly, if we were to look at using tax credits, refundable tax credits, for broader populations, we wouldn't need all the specific minutiae of how you qualify for HCTC under the TAA rules, the ATAA rules, or the PBGC rules. So presumably, we could figure out a better way.
I just think it's important to note that the $500 average premium is for the people who cleared the medical underwriting, the three-quarters of the people at Pillow Techs who never even signed up for the $1,000 a month or more coverage would have driven up the average if they could have been able to afford their share and enroll. So that's a little skewed picture, I think, of the average.
But we have no data either.
Yeah, I'd like to add one thing to that. But if in North Carolina we had been able to combine these two options together, and they didn't have a high-risk pool at the time, but they've got one that's being formed right now, the only people in that private plan pool would have not been, those high risks wouldn't have been there. And so only the higher-risk people would have gone to the high-risk pool, and the coverage automatically would have been affordable for more people there. This dual option is really a viable option that we should really look at because it will reduce the cost of coverage for a lot of people. And that's important because of something Stan said. I take it that you'd like to have group options instead of non-group. But the thing about a group option is that there's a group option's not magic. It has to do with who's in the pool. So if all we have in the pool are older and sicker people, your costs will be just as high as they are in the options that we already have. We've got to figure out how to get some real affordability in and some participation by a broader range of people into this program, and then we'll have more affordability for everybody.
Yeah, I feel a little bit like one of Jim Valvano's players now that it's basketball season. I don't know, but once he asked to be excused from basketball practice because his sister was having a baby, and he didn't know whether he was going to be an uncle or an aunt. So I'm trying to interpret what I consider really useful comments about the existing tax credit into the implications for broader scale tax slash health reform. I say there's some question because it's not clear to me that necessarily has to operate through the tax system at all, but a lot of the proposals essentially do that. So, for instance, the issue of eligibility, Roy, you mentioned that if you went to something like unemployment insurance system, you might have a simpler way to determine eligibility to solve problems. But what would that mean for if we went to a more universal system? For instance, I work sometimes on the question whether you can really income condition a credit too much, because the earned income credit, we have great trouble getting to a population because they don't know they're eligible until the following year. Are the questions of non-group market, what are the implications in terms of what we're learning about the non-group market here if we actually try to create a broader voucher credit for people? Or how about the number of transactions? I mean, all of you have mentioned the problem of the transactions that are created. How can we keep them down? Our risk pools, what do we need to worry about on risk pools? And what do we need to worry about when we go from your experience to the states and say, okay, we're going to let the states have sort of a thousand flowers bloom in the states? What are some of the implications? What are the lessons here from this tax credit if people really try to apply it on a more universal basis? And you've addressed some of this, but I wonder if you just might briefly go back to that and maybe give us some comments.
Well, first of all, tying the tax credit to the insurance begs a number of questions. One, do you have insurance? And two, how do we know whether you actually have insurance or you just say you do? Second, if you have a requirement that you can only use your tax credit for a certain type of insurance, then we have to do another round of checking to make sure that you're on the approved list of insurance rather than the unapproved list for your insurance. And then thirdly, what do we do with you if we find out you don't have the insurance that you claimed? So there are a number of mechanisms that get built in depending on how complicated you want to make this. And it's, you know, in my opinion, it's nice to say, well, you can only get the credit if you buy this type of coverage, but we have to admit that adds layers of complexity that wouldn't be there if it was usable for basically any type of insurance that you wanted.
Anyone else?
Well, you asked a lot of questions. Letting 100 flowers bloom, I think one of the lessons is that if policymakers want tax credits to achieve a particular type of coverage outcome, they need to specify that. I mean, the HCTC statute says states can come up with qualified plans and there's no rules for benefits. So quite a number of states have nothing but high deductible plans. A few states have no high deductible plans. Some offer a choice. A number of states use the non-group market. A surprising number of states use community-rated coverage. So the type of coverage that you want, you need to specify. So that's one, I think, one important lesson. I think another lesson in terms of risk pooling and what would happen with a larger program, I think with a larger program, Roy's right, you could make things a lot simpler. In terms of means testing, which was a question that Jean asked, that isn't necessarily going to be simple in the context of a tax system. And yes, the IRS is the master of the universe when it comes to income measurement, but that's last year's income measurement. People need subsidies based on current contemporaneous income, and the IRS doesn't have a mechanism for testing that. Now, there are solutions. You know, you could do things, for example, you could do what Medicare Part B does and say, well, last year's taxable income is going to presumptively determine the level of subsidy that you get. Or you could say if you got an EITC last year, you qualify for a full level of subsidy this year. Or you could say, do what Medicare Part D does, where they say, you know what, if you got Medicaid last year, you automatically qualify for low-income subsidies for Medicare Part D this year. So you could say, well, you know what, if you get food stamps, if you get other means-tested assistance, you automatically qualify. You could establish a residual means-testing program in Social Security Administration offices. They do means-testing right now for purposes of SSI administration. So there are a lot of these are complicated issues, and often people tend to say, well, we'll take care of it, we'll do means testing, we'll have bigger premium subsidies. But if you don't get the administrative details right, if you don't make it easy for the beneficiary, if you don't make sure that there's somebody, if you don't make sure there's somebody to help that beneficiary through that process, you're not going to get much enrollment. So I think there are all kinds of nitty gritty lessons that are important to take into account. I guess the final point I would mention is I think that a combination of of non-group coverage and high-risk pools is worth thinking about, particularly if it's a high-risk pool like the one that Maryland offers or the one that Minnesota offers, where there's a lot of state subsidy in it that reduces the price of the premium. A lot of the other ones are pretty tough for people to get through. The premiums are awfully, awfully high in a lot of states. But really, I think another option worth serious consideration is combining tax credits with health insurance exchanges, purchasing pools, where you have a diverse range of health plans that are available. It could function like a market, but you can have non-discrimination in premiums. It's easier for people to negotiate because they know where to go. You can avoid fraud because there's an enrollment mechanism that's distinct from the operation of each insurer. So I think that approach has a lot of promise and is worth serious exploration.
Janet or Joanne, do you want to add? Yeah, I know you talked about this to some extent already. But
yeah, I mean, I think I would piggyback on what Stan said. And you can make it simple. You can ensure better spending of federal resources and ensure that people are getting coverage that allows them to access care if you do designate it a good source of coverage and say, you go here, your credit can be used. We'll, you know, settle up, as I think Stan said, at the end of the month with Treasury. And I think it provides for better health care for the workers, lower funding, resources for the feds to have to subsidize reasonable coverage, and makes a lot of sense.
I think I do want to comment about the exchange, because I think the exchanges, the proposals that we're seeing are an interesting way to get subsidies to people, but they don't really address the affordability issue. It's not the fact that we put coverage together in a pool does not always make it less expensive. It depends. Seriously, that's a very big issue. But I just want to point out just something that's kind of, sometimes we overlook the simple and we make things much more difficult than they really need to be. And I would just point out an example of the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has an assistance program to people who meet certain income qualifications. And most of the coverage that the state approves in the individual and the group market is eligible for coverage under this particular program. There is a very, very small administrative staff that administers the whole thing. Agents and brokers and others that connect people with insurance know about this program, and they, when they find someone eligible, they send them back through it. And it's just a very simple, not tax-related subsidy that subsidizes the coverage that's already out there. It works very well. It's been working for a really long time. I mean, Oregon is not exactly a bastion of conservatism. You know, they're a pretty mid-range state, and a lot of people get coverage through. It's the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, and it works quite well. It's also administered by the same people that administer their high-risk pools, so if someone doesn't qualify, they're an individual market buyer. If they don't qualify there, then it's easy for them to be converted over to the high-risk pool coverage, which is one of the affordable states, by the way. Oregon's coverage is quite affordable, one of the best. And the whole thing works very smoothly. So it's not a tax credit, but it is a subsidy program. And like you, Gene, I'm not convinced that we have to do this through the tax system, although we have this great infrastructure built. I hope that we could use it effectively. It actually is a pretty sophisticated system.
I know.
Just one last comment. This tax credit, we also need to remember, it's a flat percentage tax credit, so there's no variability for people with lower income to get more assistance than they would, and presumably somebody, although they may have lost their job, could be the spouse of somebody on Wall Street who doesn't need a subsidy, yet they could potentially be eligible for that. So presumably we wouldn't do that if this were a broader population. We would make some variation in terms of the value of the subsidy be higher for those individuals who fell into lower income range. The tax system is not the easiest place to go and say, I just lost my job, please recompute my income for tax purposes. We don't do things that way. We kind of wait till the end of the tax year and see how things shake out. But if you're going to make it refundable and advanceable, you have to think about how we would actually do that to make it worthwhile to people so that they maintain their coverage like we want them to and not go without coverage and then potentially be left out of the system later.
I was reminded literally yesterday of how the complexity of these issues plays through in the real world of families. I had a lady who called me somewhat randomly from Minnesota. She was divorced. Her husband's former wife was disabled. One of the children from their marriages was also disabled. They were attempting to qualify for a DI, SSI for these people. This particular family, the husband had just moved to making $31,000 a year, so he had just moved out of Medicaid eligibility for that family, but the child was eligible through SCHIP, and she didn't know how to negotiate the system, and I couldn't imagine that I would try to be able to figure it out either. We want to turn to the audience now, and I'd like to ask you to identify yourself before you ask a question. I'd like to ask you to please ask a question. You may precede the question with a very, very brief statement, if that helps clarify this question, but please, please make it a question. And please also wait for the microphones. We have a couple microphones here that will come around to you. So someone like to start? Get a question right here.
Hi, I'm Barbara Smith. I'm a health policy consultant. And I just wanted to precede my question with a reality check of sorts, personal story. My husband's firm converted all of their professionals from employees to independent contractors. And we then had to go out into the individual market. Everybody in that category did. Insurance premiums in that market for what was basically a healthy population with no serious catastrophic illnesses ranged from $26,000 per family to $36,000 per family. No catastrophic illnesses. Problems from seasonal allergies to migraine headaches. So this is basically what the reality is for people out there. My question is, in terms of bringing this to scale for health reform, why it would be necessary to segment this population separately from the population as a whole at all, if you couldn't have pools that had employers participating, that had individuals participating, that had, you know, all the streams in the health insurance able to go to the same pool so that you could basically aggregate the risk as much as possible. And then the second thing is that if you make it seamless, as Stan was talking about, where you basically have people where the credit is paid into the pool or whatever the financing source is, and then the individual pays only what they owe on a net basis. Why would that tax credit structure be any different from just the sliding scale subsidy?
I wanted to answer the end of your question, Barbara, by quoting that great sage Stuart Butler. Tax credits are just money that Republicans can vote for. That, you know, Barbara's question was, why a tax credit? You know, if it's, why not just a break on the premium? Why not just a subsidy administered by HHS? And I think the answer is, if you want to have health reform that has bipartisan support, you need to think about, is there a way to make tax credits work?
I think on the coverage options, I think it did take some effort in some states. There are some states that were hit hard right away. And, Pennsylvania comes to mind, and I have a colleague here who used to be with the steelworkers at the time, that they really dug in with the governor and the heads of the four different Blues plans and figured out the coverage that people could get into and minimize gaps in coverage and everything else. But in other states, where there isn't the political will or there are fewer people affected, the incentives are not there to come up with a whole different structure. I don't know what Janet's, you know, possible explanation would be for why so many went to high-risk pools, but they are mechanisms that were in place. There was seed money in the TAA bill also to help states with their administrative costs to run or set up new pools. So there was perhaps an additional incentive there for those. But it is a little bit of a chicken and an egg. You know, if there were bigger numbers, there might be more willingness of states to come up with something, but just adding more eligibles to the list of people who can get this without addressing the fundamental flaws that affect take-up rate, you're not really, in reality, growing the program in a way that commands more political support for better options in the states at their, you know, due to their action.
Yeah, I would just comment about why, to answer your question about, you know, why it was difficult. I was really shocked, I have to tell you. We thought that it would be much simpler than it was. And some of the states where the most difficult were quite surprising as to who they were. And in general, what the problem was is that it did require some pretty heavy lifting on the part of the state primarily because the rules for this program are completely different than every other market rule in any market that they already had. And so it was reinventing the wheel for a potentially very small number of people, and they just couldn't get a lot of takers for it. And so the political will wasn't there for such a small group, but just, you know, financially making it an attractive enough option that anybody wanted to do it. So I think you mentioned, you know, why couldn't we just put everybody in the same pool? Well, I think it would be nice if everyone in a state had the same rules, basically. Not, you know, particularly in certain markets. You know, if they're an individual buying, there are these rules, and it doesn't matter whether you're eligible for a tax credit or you're not. It would be nice if everyone was subject to the same rules. We would have avoided many of these problems if that had been the case. It was because of having to set up these separate systems for a small number of people. But even if you were doing it for a larger number of people, it's just not as efficient. And so if we could have had the same rules, it would have worked a lot better.
Just one final comment to note that if everyone who did not have employer-based insurance could deduct the cost of their insurance from their income today, like those of us who have employer insurance could do, they would receive a much greater subsidy than even under the HCTC.
Thank you. Bob Rosenblatt, freelance writer. All of you mentioned affordability as being a real problem why the people in North Carolina didn't take it up. And I wonder if you could relate this to the presidential campaign where I think affordability will be an issue. I'd like to ask each of you whether, based on your research or anecdotal discussion with workers, whether you what your number is for people to be able to afford health care insurance. Is it 1% of income, 3%, 5%, or 10% of income? A level at which you can expect people to buy and afford health insurance?
Well, I think it depends on your income. I think it depends on your income. I don't think you can say, you know, to pick a number randomly, that everybody pays 10%. Some people have that much disposable income. Some people don't. And, you know, if you want to focus, again, on the low-income uninsured, where most of the uninsured are, under 200% of the federal poverty level, only very small payments are consistent with a high level of voluntary participation. Very, very small payments.
And I think perhaps more, at least as important as the percent of income that you might set it at, is what counts towards
right.
that. It should not just be the premiums, but all out-of-pocket costs. Because, again, in a day of high-deductible plans, just subsidizing a premium for coverage that doesn't actually get your doctor bills paid for is a problem.
Bob, I'd just remind you that if we're spending 16% of GDP on health care and well over 20% of personal income on health care, not everybody can only spend 10%. Although, again, that's not just insurance. I'm counting everything, such as nursing home and Medicare. But the percentage is not just what we think people can pay, but we have to cover the cost.
Right, but remember, most of the health care spending is on a tiny fraction of the population, the sickest fraction of the population. So what people can afford out of pocket is something quite different.
Jill Wexler with Manage Healthcare Magazine. You mentioned some reauthorization legislation this year. Is there any viable possibility that any of these issues will be addressed in legislation this year, or is this something that's really just going to be part of the long-term ongoing healthcare reform debate?
Oh, I think it's very much up for potential action this year. The House has already passed a TAA reauthorization bill that would increase the percentage of the premium covered by the credit to 85%. It would end HCTC after 2009, because I think there are a lot of folks in the House who think that this has just been a failure and we should ultimately end it. But in the meantime, let's raise the percentage. In the Senate, Senator Baucus has introduced a bill, S-1848, I think is the number, that would also raise the premium percentage up to 85%. Senator Rockefeller has introduced a bill that would raise it to 95%. Both bills make other reforms as well. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the Finance Committee marking it up over the next month or so. Because, you know, Senator Baucus has made clear to the administration that he doesn't plan to consider trade deals until TAA gets reauthorized. So I think there is actually a good chance of action on this year.
Although the administration has threatened to veto the House passed bill, so I don't know where that leaves things in terms of actually getting it enacted.
I wonder also if any of you detect that there's going to be some conflict over who would be covered. I mean, certainly if the number of unemployed go up, you know, is it a question of do you only get it if you're unemployed through something called trade adjustment assistance?
Yeah, that's right. And that's right. And back, but the last time we had an economic downturn, a huge question was, would the stimulus package include help for displaced workers to buy health insurance? And they couldn't work out a deal. The president proposed a 60% tax credit. The Democrats in Congress proposed a Medicaid expansion and a COBRA subsidy, and they could never bridge that ideological gap. I would hope they could have more success this time.
Let me catch over here. Always miss the people in the corners.
Hi, this could be a... Sorry, I'm Suzanne Haviland from AFSCME, and this could be a two-part, or could be for Joanne or Janet, but one is that, you know, you mentioned that a lot of states had the option to buy into the state employee health plan, and you said that there are reasons and you don't want to go into them necessarily, but if you could specify what you think maybe some key pieces were. And then a corollary question for Stan, which was that you talked about the fact that it would be better for, or potentially better for, there to be more specification as to what kind of plans and, you know, how would that be done? Obviously, there were some guidelines or some things that were set up, but those aren't necessarily working, and I can imagine what some of those would be, but I'd be interested to hear that.
Well, I'll go ahead and start first. So basically, a state employee plan, or the federal plan for that matter, is an employer-sponsored plan. So that's the first premise that you go from. In any employer-sponsored plan, the risk characteristics within the group are driven by the employees that work there. They have a certain time that they're eligible for coverage. You know, they can come in during annual enrollment or when they're first hired. They have a large employer contribution paying part of the premium. And so these things mitigate overall losses in any employer-sponsored plan, including a state employee program. So any employer plan that has this amount of control over what the risks are because they're paying a lot and also because they can control who goes in and who goes out, is very reluctant to let an unknown risk come into it. The state programs are no different than any other large employer plan which would have you know, the same issues, and that's why it is. Now, some people have said, well, the way you get around that is you set up a parallel pool for these people. But keep in mind, I know I've said it three times, so I'm going to say it again. The costs within the pool are only as good as who's in the pool. And then if the pool is comprised primarily of people who have higher health risks or they're older, unfortunately, as we get older, our expenses are higher, then it won't really help with the costs that you sort of attached them to the pool. And so that's why the states haven't done it. It's just this basic reason. They don't want, if they let these unknown risks in the pool, they're concerned that it will drive up costs for the people who are already in their pool over which they have a little bit better control.
I would guess, too, that the health insurers themselves would not. I mean, they sort of get a, they'd certainly maintain more control in the mostly medically underwritten options under arrangement with insurer now that I think they would have, you know, if they put them in a state employee plan, everyone would get the same premium. This allows them, the current situation, more control to set prices according to who they think they're getting than at least the cross-subsidization you would get in those pools, separate or the same.
And to answer your second question, I'll tell you what I would think about if I were trying to find a bipartisan solution to this issue, given how much disagreement there is on what a health insurance plan should look like. You have some people who are passionately committed to high deductible plans. You have other people who believe that coverage more like what private employers offer their employees is needed to provide good access to health care. You can tell from the objective impartial way that I put it which side of the divide I fall on. But, you know, recognizing that there is that divide, I would think about saying, why not require each state to make at least one plan available in each of those categories. And if a state chooses not to do so, have the federal government step in and make a plan in that category available. That way, workers in each state with the tax credit would have access to both high deductible and more comprehensive coverage. That's in the context of HCTC. More broadly, I think it's worth thinking about an insurance purchasing pool with a range of different benefits from which people can choose, and with tax credits that are based on income, that subsidize benefits and make comprehensive coverage affordable, but ask people to pay more money if they pick more comprehensive, more costly coverage.
Rick Curtis, Institute for Health Policy Solutions. Janet has mentioned a couple of times, and it's just fact, the cost of people in a pool depends on what their risk profile is.
I'll speak up just a tiny bit.
Okay. Oregon was referenced. They have a very well-run program, which does run both a risk pool and a premium assistance program. The cost per capita for the premium for the people who are bought into the individual market are inexpensive because 20% of the applicants get referred to the risk pool, and the reason is it's still very cheap for those people to participate in the risk pool because the percentage subsidy of those very high premiums is high. The total per capita cost is not low, and that brings us around to the point of who does pay for the high-risk people. Now, so far the comments seem to be oriented on what are the lessons for a voluntary market. And I'd like to ask whichever the panelist wants to comment, what are the lessons for a market where we're covering everybody and where the low risks have to participate? So if any of you have a different observation about what the lessons are and how you would design it, I'd appreciate it.
Well, if low-risk people participate, then the premiums come down for everybody. And so it's beneficial to encourage lower-risk people to participate, whether by mandate or automatic enrollment mechanisms where you have to opt out if you don't want to get covered. There's a lot of ways to skin that cat, but I think you're right, and I think Janet's absolutely right. If you have a high-risk bunch of enrollees, no matter how you divvy up the premiums, it's going to be pretty darn costly. So you need to get the good risks in there, too.
Stan, one of the issues that's been raised there is whether low-income young people should subsidize high-income older people, for instance. How far do you carry that?
Yeah, of course. As a high-risk older person, I say, yeah. Your knees don't ache, you can help pay for mine, by golly. It's interesting. Public opinion polls show people think you shouldn't be paying different premiums based on how old you are, how young you are, how healthy you are, how sick you are. I think people understand, people, number one, have the sense that, you know, a market good, insurance is a market good, you should pay a certain amount for it, regardless of who you are. But second, there's a sense of solidarity. You know, I was once young, now I'm an old geezer, and I'll soon be an older geezer, God willing. And we, by coming together, we make life easier for those points in the life cycle when it would be pretty tough to do it on our own. So, yeah.
I've heard, I just have to say, you know, we in our world have Taft-Hartley funds, which are these funds that collect money from employers that are subject to a union contract, and they jointly administer the funds to provide health insurance with labor and employer representatives. And whenever a young person stands up in those meetings and says, why are my premiums going up to pay for these older people? Someone says, because your father's in the same plan, or your father retired from the plan, or you'll be, hopefully, retired from this plan in 20 years, 30 years, whatever it is. So solidarity may be hard to achieve more broadly, but we get it at least in our Taft-Hartley funds.
Because we're running out of time, if you've had your hand raised, what I'm going to do is try to go around, I think there are about two or three, and just let all of you ask your questions real quickly, and we'll see how much we can get in the way of answers. But I don't want to cut up. But if you've had your hand raised already, please give us your question real quick. But please try to keep it very brief.
Thanks. Ryan Ellis, Americans for Tax Reform. Quick question I wanted to throw out there is the way that these refundable credits score. They score out as both a revenue loss and an outlay. That creates a problem if you offset it with, let's say, capping the employer exclusion. Let's say you could end up with a net tax increase, even though it looks like it's revenue neutral at first. That could be a deal breaker for a lot of Republicans. And if this is going to be a linchpin for trying to get health care reform through, that's one thing that could really derail it. I wanted to comment on that.
We had, I think, two else, we had some. Just real quick.
Ryan Hess with the Employment and Training Reporter. Some might argue that the health care tax credit exists as a training support, enabling workers who have skills that are of diminishing value in the economy to engage in training during a period of unemployment so they have more valuable skills. I was wondering, when you're talking about expanding health coverage, looking at this model, how you would address that in a political argument.
Here. Have I missed anybody?
I just I couldn't let the comment pass. We, the younger generation, are supposed to subsidize the. Well, I don't want to point to anybody here, but yeah. So does that mean that the IRA that I've already started setting up, I don't really need that anymore because Social Security is going to be around in 50 years? I mean. You're telling me that I'm going to get the benefit of it, but as far as I'm concerned, I don't see any benefit 50 years from now. I mean, there's no guarantee on that, and frankly, I don't trust you guys.
So, panelists, please respond if you can. Did I miss anybody here? Had a hand raised? Okay, so please respond to either of these questions or any last comment you want to make. We'll just go across the way.
I'll just quickly, I think the comment about the potential concern on the budget side is real for some Republicans, and that may be a factor that has to be addressed.
Sorry? Anything? Any last comment?
We need to work on you. National basic social insurance concepts, right, Paul? We're going to, yeah.
Well, I would like to comment to the last person, because, you know, I think the whole issue of community rating, although it's the most wonderful idea that we can all ever hear of, in fact, we have it doesn't work. You know, the states that currently use it have significantly higher costs because people don't want to be in the system. And if we thought that we could really enforce an individual mandate and make everybody be in, it might work. But I'm not convinced that we have a mechanism to enforce an individual mandate yet. We haven't been very good with our auto insurance mandate, so I need a little bit more convincing in that area. And so in the meantime, what I've observed over many years is that markets that do this, the costs are significantly higher and the young people drop out. And I worry about that because it doesn't achieve the goal of what I think we need to do, which is get everybody in.
Well, we have community rating in a couple contexts. You're right, in the individual market, in a voluntary individual market, it can be problematic. You're absolutely right, Janet. But 61% of non-elderly residents of the country get their coverage from employers, and we all pay the same premium, whether we're young or old. Do you get your health insurance coverage from your employer?
Yeah, I do. But for the 4 months after I graduated from college, and before I got a job, I was uninsured.
Right. Now, when you were during those 4 months, you could have gone out into the individual market and gotten a. You look like a young, healthy guy. You could have gotten a pretty reasonable premium, but you didn't. And now you're in the employer, and you're actually paying for the old geezers at your company because you and the geezers are paying
Don't
the identical
make him drop coverage.
Premium rate. Pardon me?
Don't make him drop coverage.
Yes.
You completely ruin your argument.
But you know what? If life goes well for you, someday you'll be old with gray hair like me, and you'll want younger people to be involved in that same insurance system. And so the question is, if we over time, if we can all say, you know what, we're in this together, and we're going to support one another, then the thing can work. But if people say, I'm dropping out right now, then you'll be in trouble too when you get older.
I'd like to actually cut off here. What we'll do at the end of the session, we'll put the young people over here. The old people, if they can make it, we'll put on this side of the room. And we'll continue the discussion. I'd like to thank our panelists. I think they did an extraordinarily well job. But thank you, audience.